bienvenue à toutes et à tous. Je vais présenter Rob Phillips en anglais, exceptionnellement, en ce qui me concerne. So it's an immense pleasure to introduce Rob Phillips, who is a Fred and Nancy Morris Professor of Biophysics, Biology and Physics at Caltech in California. Rob Phillips is unlike anyone else you may meet in conferences, university departments, or seminars. He grew up in San Diego in a home filled with books, and that led to a love for reading and writing books that is continued to this day. Rob Phillips received his BS in biophysics from the University of Minnesota by independent study, because he decided not to go to college but to live his own adventure for about 10 years. And he also received his PhD in condensed matter physics in the University of Washington in 1989. He was appointed assistant professor at Brown University in 1993 and professor at Caltech in 2000. After an early career in condensed matter physics, Rob Phillips devoted his next part of his life to biology, because he found in biology a source of inspiration that would capture his full commitment to this day. Scientists, whether biologists or physicists, did not understand and still do not understand this most complex state of organization and dynamics of matter, that is living matter. So he turned to biology in search for new physics and principles to be discovered. Work in his laboratory emphasizes the unity of perspective and the predictive power that comes from formulating biological hypotheses in mathematical language, and the interplay between the mathematization of biological models and the use of careful measurements to test them experimentally. Rob Phillips worked on many different topics, ranging from the mechanics and energetics of viruses, of cell membranes, to the energetics of cell organization and cell growth, but also his current efforts focus on the language of gene regulation in bacteria through transcription, cell adaptation in the context of physiology, as well as biology by the numbers, as we will hear today, including biomass on Earth. I will not say a word of the many prizes and prestigious awards that he has received, because he genuinely thinks this is irrelevant and I do not want to embarrass him. Yet, I shall rather say a few words about the person, the scientist, and the teacher. In fact, these are not three independent beings, tactically compartmentalized or concealed from one another, but a unified whole with passion, scientific rigor, naivety, and even empathy. Rob Phillips is one of these handful people that I've met in nearly 30 years of life in laboratories that has the capacity to literally transform someone's scientific life. Through his research, teaching at Caltech, Woods Hole, and hundreds of other places in the world, field trips on evolution in the Galapagos Islands or the Wallace Line in Indonesia, and discussions, Rob Phillips has transformed the life of thousands of students, postdocs, and young researchers, or even older ones like me. This owes to the following traits that are seldom found in the same person: passion and curiosity, a breadth and depth of knowledge in physics and biology that you will see in his lectures here. This allows him to see analogies few people can see and to address problems in new ways. Second, an exquisite attention to details that is coupled to a love for biological phenomena and formal mathematical language to capture the physics of life. Thirdly, quantitative thinking that is unfortunately too rare among scientists, and the conviction that this is a necessary step to grow an intimate relationship with the living world and hopefully to decipher the secrets of life. Fourthly, the search for principles and unity of concepts that transcend scales and systems. We'll hear one of examples of that in his lectures. And last but not least, humility and humor, so that he reaches out to people he interacts with. Rob Phillips is an extraordinary pedagogue. He can rework through virtually anyone's research paper, whether in physics or biology, and explain the work better than the authors can do. This is all magnificently captured in his books, The Physical Biology of the Cell, which will remain for a long while the book that physicist students will read to understand what physics can bring to bear on the understanding of living matter, and that biologists will read to learn physics. It is a wonderful opportunity to have Rob Phillips among us in this lovely month of May in Paris. Rob Phillips will be available to discuss after his lectures today and the other days that he will give lectures in May. Thank you, Rob, very much for being with us. We look forward to your next four lectures. And now comes a little present.
Oh, boy.
Could you please come to me?
I'm a little reluctant, but yes.
It is just this great medal that the Collège de France have to open it the correct way. Here you go. Sorry, that was the other way around.
Wow.
So who is this? Guillaume Budé, who has a statue outside.
Yeah, I saw.
Okay, anyways, this is your present.
Thanks. So weird to hear Thomas call me Rob Phillips. That's so weird. I'll never live up to that introduction. It's a huge pleasure to be here, and we've been waiting for this for a long time, Thomas and me, and I'm really excited to be here, so I look forward to talking to everybody. Let's just see if I can figure this out. So before I even start, I just want to say that it's very hard to reach the point where I have the opportunity to give a series of talks at the Collège de France without feeling a great sense of being honored. It's a huge privilege. And you know, one of the things I want to do is say thank you to the many, many people that have really been most transformative to me. And that above all is the people that I write books with. You can see up there, Thomas and Wallace Marshall and I are working on a book. My group, and especially my family, and my dad recently left us, and you know, this thing about not going to college, it's, you can't imagine telling your parents when you're 17 years old you're going to quit high school and not go to college. They really supported me, and you'll see how it fits into my story here. So I want to start out just by commenting on the idea of a public lecture. So probably many of you know that in the early 1940s, Erwin Schrödinger gave a very famous set of public lectures in Dublin, which then became the book, What is Life?, which I love very much. And having been at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole for 15 years, we have something called the Friday Evening Lectures. And these lectures are given by scientists and meant to be available to the public. And often what I would see after the lectures is that nobody was happy. The scientists felt that the work was not represented in an honest fashion. The lay people maybe felt that it was too technical. And so it's a very demanding thing to try to give a talk that people will understand. I also think it's just funny to see what Linus Pauling, a very famous chemist, had to say. Schrödinger's discussion of thermodynamics is vague and superficial to an extent that should not be tolerated even in a popular lecture. I think that Pauling is wrong, by the way. But nevertheless, you know, it's a tall task. I also want to say that I really, truly love the scheme of the Collège de France. I'm not gonna translate these things for you, but this is a great biography of De Gennes, in my opinion. And what I've circled in green is something that meant a lot to me the first time I learned about it, which is a long time ago now, which has to do with the idea of every summer that De Gennes, and I know every year I watch Thomas, when he has to work hard to prepare his lectures. And I think, you know, I don't know how many of you have thought about it, but the notion of giving a new course every year at a high level is very demanding. And it leads people to be quite creative in very beautiful ways. So De Gennes was highly creative. If you go look at Thomas' lectures, if you look at Jean-Francois' lectures, Edith Hurd, you know, all of these people do extremely clever things. So I'm a real fan. So what I wanted to say is that I'm gonna give four lectures whose intent is really a kind of tourism. It's an intellectual tourism. I want you to imagine that we're on a safari together, that I've got a pair of binoculars. Every now and then I'm gonna say, oh wow, look over there, and I'm gonna show you something. But if you really wanted to understand, for example, the change in the length of tusks of the elephants, you'd have to do more probing. So what I wanted to say is there's not a single thing that I'm going to tell you that if you want more details, you cannot find. One of the outcomes of the pandemic for me is that I did about 200 of these short vignettes. They're each, you can see, they're between 12 and 15 or so minutes long. And again, if you want the details, they exist. All right? So this is going to be superficial. I can't really help that. So let me give you a little bit of a feel for what I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to start out today with one theme in mind, and that is to address the question of what sets the scale of X. And I will explain what I mean by that, where X could be a great variety of different things. Next week, I'm going to talk about what I like to call sameness, and it has to do with one of the great inheritances of physics, which is that things that are ostensibly look like they're different, in fact, when viewed through the prism of mathematics, we learn that they're the same. And I'm going to use what I consider to be biology's greatest model, which is the Monod-Wyman-Schange model of allostery, as a window onto this idea of sameness. 2 weeks from today, I'm going to talk about what I consider to be one of the secrets of life, which is the way that energy, free energy, is harvested to allow us to defy the statement Napoleon is in equilibrium. There was a famous talk given by a physicist. And he gave this talk, and some biochemist thought he was going to have a gotcha moment. And at the end, he says to the guy, Napoleon is in equilibrium, with some big drama, as though he'd really caught this guy in some terrible error of thinking. Equilibrium is a question of time scales. We even use equilibrium when we think about the interior of the sun, so give me a break. You know, it's more subtle than just to have a knee-jerk reaction. But I do want to say it's very interesting the way that free energy payment can be used to do a myriad of different interesting biological things. And then the last part, the fourth of my lectures, will be on a fantasy in which we pretend that there's no such thing as atoms. It'll be what I will refer to as a field theory of matter, and you'll see where I'm going with that when I get there. So today, I have two main things in mind. I want to start out by talking about what I'm going to refer to as a feeling for the organism, in which we try to hold up biological phenomena and look at them and feel them from a number of different perspectives and see to what extent we can understand them. Having set up that sort of philosophy, then what I will do is turn to a bunch of examples of this what sets the scale of X idea. And then if you want to pursue them more deeply, you can watch my YouTube videos in which I truly explain how to do the details of the calculations. So my inspiration for this notion of the feeling for the organism is Barbara McClintock, one of my scientific heroes. She's one of my scientific heroes, among other things, because she resisted. She wanted to defy, in a way, the molecular biology revolution and study the nature of chromosomes and try to understand what that nature of the chromosomes, the sort of thing you see right here, implied about the phenotype. And so she bravely, for many years, she resisted. People really thought that she was barking up the wrong tree. And what I love is, if you read the book by Evelyn Fox Keller called A Feeling for the Organism, one of her best statements, I think, was she could write the autobiography of every plant she worked with. She generally did not work with grad students. She wanted to go from seed all the way to the full plant. And she wanted to have an intimate relationship, those were her own words, with every single plant. And she thought that they developed too fast. So I love that. Over and over again, she tells us, one must have the time to look, the patience to hear what the material has to say to you, the openness to let it come to you. Above all, one must have a feeling for the organism. And so what I want to do is cultivate this idea of a feeling for the organism, but from the point of view of quantitative thinking. Not with any sort of patriotism where I say this is the only way that one can do it, but rather to say this is my own subjective love, is trying to use that as a prism through which to view biological and other phenomena. So how might we get a feeling for the organism in this day and age? So many of you might have heard that it's popular to say we're living in the era of big data, and I can certainly substantiate that. For example, at the NIH, the database on nucleotides has 10 to the 17th letters deposited. Just to put that in perspective, the complete works of Shakespeare is 4 million letters. So we're talking about 100 billion copies of the complete works of Shakespeare. That's how much sequence information we have. I consider that a bit problematic. The US Library of Congress has about 50 million books, and yet we've collected 100 billion copies of the complete works of Shakespeare worth of sequence information. We have 100,000 protein structures. And I very much have always loved this quote from Poincaré, which I learned as a 17-year-old. I'll say it to you in English, but I think you'll take pleasure if you read it in French. Science is built up of facts as a house is built up of bricks, but a mere accumulation of facts is no more a science than a pile of bricks is a house. It does do well in French, I have to say. So the question is, how do we take modern big data and turn a spreadsheet like the thing on the right into poetry? How do we make it speak to us? How do we let it, to use McClintock's words, come to us? How do we hear it? How do we feel it? Because if you're like me, that does not tell you anything. And I could show you a spreadsheet that I have of Tycho Brahe's data for the position of Mars. It's a spreadsheet too. It will not tell you anything about elliptical orbits. It'll just be a bunch of stupid numbers, you know? So the question is, how do we come to terms with this stuff? So one of the ways that I intend to do this is to appeal to what I will refer to as Fermi problems. So Enrico Fermi was a very noted 20th century physicist. He died at a very young age of cancer and made a huge impact both as an experimentalist and as a theorist. And Hans Bethe, a very noted physicist, once said of him that he could get a numerical answer to any question in physics within 15 minutes. And I think that it's largely true. It may be approximate, but he could get a numerical answer in 15 minutes. So this notion of Fermi problems refers to the idea of problems which you pose. For example, how many piano tuners are there in Chicago? Here's one I did. So if you wake up early, as I did when I lived here, to hang out with Pierre over there, every morning I went swimming, okay? Every morning. I usually went to the Piscine de Pontoise, and I would see the guys in the green suits, and they'd be cleaning up Paris and making it perfect. And one of the things you can try to estimate, how many people come through Charles de Gaulle Airport every year? How much is the salaries of all those guys? And what is the volume each day of cigarette butts that they pick up? It's fun. It's pretty interesting. A good street to think about is Rue Mouffetard. If you go there, down Rue Mouffetard in the morning, it's a disaster. And by 8 o'clock, perfect, right? So anyway, there's lots of fun estimates like that to do. And one of the things that I want to emphasize is the difference between what I'm going to refer to as factual knowledge and conceptual knowledge. So let me try and make that point. So we have this great scientific book of nature, and there's a part of that book which is a bunch of facts. And the facts are awesome. So for example, we know the crystal structures of a great variety of ion channels, such as the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor or the cyclic nucleotide gated channels. And we've also measured, not me, but other people have measured the relationship between current and the driving force, which is the concentration of some ligand. So I would call those facts. But in fact, as I'll show next week, one can actually unify a huge variety of different facts about vastly different kinds of proteins, hemoglobin, ion channels, G protein coupled receptors, etc., using one simple idea, which is that of allostery, in the language of statistical mechanics. And again, next week I'll make a big deal about this, but I would call that conceptual knowledge as opposed to factual knowledge. And it's a game changer in the sense that the way we think about these molecules is very different than if we're thinking about, oh, the structure of that ion channel is such and such, or the structure of hemoglobin is such and such. Here's one saying, I can abstract away those details and replace it by that single equation. So the philosophy that I'm going to bring, as I already said, is sort of this Fermi problem thing. And the way I want you to think of it is inspired by a movie with Tom Hanks that I like a lot called Castaway, where he works for FedEx. He's on an airplane. The airplane crashes. He's the sole survivor. He ends up on an island for 5 years with a bunch of debris from the plane. And one of the things he does, he finds himself very lonely. He starts talking to a volleyball. You might remember that the American volleyball company is called Wilson. So he names this volleyball Wilson. He paints a face on it and so on. And the way I always talk to my students, I say, I want you to imagine you're on an island, no iPhone, no nothing, and you want to figure out something like the mass of the sun. And actually, with some work, all of us could do it without knowing much of anything other than the size of the Earth's orbit or something like that. So we're going to do stick-in-the-sand style estimates. And so that's kind of the approach that I will bring. I also wanted to just say, because I very much enjoy, this is another set of very famous public lectures called the Messenger Lectures that were given by Richard Feynman, a very well-known physicist, and I like this particular comment. He says, as we look into these things, we get an aesthetic pleasure from them directly on observation. And you know, that could be something like the flying of a bird. It could be the swimming of fish in the presence, a school of fish in the presence of a sea lion. It could be looking at a molecule diffusing. But there's also a rhythm and a pattern between the phenomena of nature which isn't apparent to the eye, but only to the eye of analysis. And it is these rhythms and patterns which we call physical laws. And so I'm excited about this idea of the rhythms and patterns of the living. So what am I going to do today? I will use some ideas for making estimates. And one of the things I hope that you'll carry away from this that's both entertaining and powerful is we're going to use all of our numbers are going to either be 1, few, or 10. And I'm going to use the arithmetic rule, few times few is 10. And also 1 over few is few over 10. Those are my two main rules for doing arithmetic. The other thing I'm going to do is if I don't know the answer to something, if I don't know the size of something, I'm going to make a guess. And the way I'm going to make a guess is I'm going to come from below to make a low guess. I'm going to come from above, and then I'm going to take the product of my guesses and take the square root. That amounts to taking an average on a log scale, effectively. Okay, so let me try to give you a few examples of this idea of intuition that comes from doing estimates. So the first one has to do with a calculation that was done by Newton himself very long ago and is related to this figure. So this figure on the upper right is one of the great figures in the history of science. It's where Newton says, oh my gosh, that subject of projectiles that Galileo was thinking about and that subject of elliptical orbits that Kepler was thinking about are the same subject. If I shoot my projectile off of a mountain fast enough, it'll keep falling over the horizon, and that's what we will call an orbit. So this is page 392 of Newton's book. I didn't make this up. This is just page 392. Just go look at it. And what he says there is he says he wants to know the question of how far an object falls when I drop it. And the answer is it falls, sorry for the units, but if you're an American of my age group, you would have learned that the acceleration due to gravity is 32 feet per second per second. That's the way you would have learned it. James Joyce in Ulysses has this whole thing where Leopold Bloom, his main character, is walking around Dublin, and I've looked it up. He keeps stopping, and it'll be like, 32 feet per second per second. What does this second per second mean? What are those people talking about? Like, it's very confusing. But if you remember this equation, S is 1/2 GT squared. This is how far a body falls. 1/2 times 32 times 1 second gives me 16 feet. So Newton tells us that. Then he asks an amazing question. How far does the moon fall in 1 minute? If I turned off gravity, the moon would just keep going straight. But because of gravity, it falls in its orbit. And so over here, what he does is he says, well, interestingly, the distance to the moon is 60 Earth radii. How wild is that? Because now that means the strength of gravity there is 1 over 60 squared. And if I take 60 seconds, this 60 squared cancels that 60 squared, and you end up with it falls 16 feet. This estimate inspired Newton. It gave him the sense that he was on the right track as he thought about the inverse square law of gravity. It was an estimate. Next, equally impressive. So Maxwell, James Clerk Maxwell, one of the great physicists of the 19th century, was thinking about electricity and magnetism. He ended up finding out that there was an equation that described the motion of the electric and magnetic phenomena, which is what's now known as a wave equation, the same kind of a wave equation that describes the waves in Biarritz, something I know and love. And so he got an equation, and this equation featured a speed. Right now, this looks obscure. But here's what happened when he thought about it. He said, wow, that speed I get is given as 1 over the square root of two quantities that I know of that have nothing to do with light or electric or waves. They have to do with how much force there is between two charges and how much magnetic field you'll get from a current of wire. And on this page, he says, whoa, I calculate the speed. It looks a lot like a number I already know, the speed of light. And what he does up here is he compares them and he says, I have reason to think that light is an electromagnetic phenomena. So he does this estimate, he finds a speed, and mind-blowingly, the speed he finds, which is about electricity, is the speed of light. Very beautiful. Okay, so what I'm going to try and say at this point is that a root to a feeling for what sets the scale of x is to actually try to understand what the numbers are that arise in various biological phenomena, and then to try to reason them out. So that prepares me for the main part of what I want to say, which is I want to comment on this notion of what sets the scale of X. So let me give you some examples. So I want to develop intuition for biological phenomena by developing a sense of what sets their scale. So for example, let's look at the upper left. You probably realize that if the diameter of an elephant's leg was more narrow, it would buckle. In the same way that if you take a straw and you push on it, it will buckle. And so the question you can ask is, what sets the scale of the diameter of the leg? Over on the right, the height of a mountain is a very fun question to ask. Here's one, you know, that I think many of you would be interested in, which is, what is the ratio of the mass of all the cows on Earth to all the wild megafauna? Is it a factor of 1? Is it a factor of 10? Is it a factor of 30? Is it a factor of 100? And can we figure that out by pure thought? So all these are the kinds of things that I'll talk about. So I guess I should have said that this is a subjective view, but my personal take is, if I can't answer the question of what sets the scale of a given problem, I don't understand it. So that's the take that I'm going to try and offer. So let me just give you one example. So let's say I wanted to figure out the height of mountains. What's the height that they can actually be? So I won't do it because it's a little rude, but here is some chalk. I could put this chalk on the ground and stand on it, and it will crush. And yet I could put an ant on it, and it will not crush. I could put a cat on it, it will not crush. And so there's some critical load at which this thing will crush. I'm going to call that the yield stress. It's the force per unit area that's enough to make this crush. And so here, the idea is that the height a mountain can reach is the height of rock that weighs enough to crush the rock at the bottom. Any height less than that, and the mountain is fine, but any height taller than that, and the rock at the bottom will be crushed. It's a very simple statement because I'm looking at the force per unit area, and that needs to be equal to this critical material thing called the yield stress. And so from that, you can estimate the height. It depends on the yield stress, the density of the rock, and g. Now, if we were thinking about Mars, instead of being 10 meters per second squared, which is g on Earth, it's 3.7 meters per second squared. So instead of predicting 10 kilometers is the height of mountains, we predict 24 kilometers. The highest mountain in the solar system, if I remember correctly, is 22 kilometers, and it's on Mars. And so this is a notion of having a sense of the scale of things. Galileo, when he was a young man, had this very weird idea. He decided to try to understand whether the structures in Dante's Inferno would actually survive. So last night we were looking at Notre Dame. Some of you might think that the flying buttresses are beautiful, maybe, I don't know. But I will tell you this, originally those flying buttresses are there for a reason other than beauty. They're there because when you make walls too tall and you put a roof on top, the walls break. And people discovered that empirically. And so he was curious, if I made buildings and stuff the size of what Dante described, would that place be stable? And it led him to the mechanics of things like buckling. So when he got punished, you might remember that Galileo said various things about the solar system. He wasn't entirely generous with the Pope. He ended up, unlike Giordano Bruno, he didn't get burned at the stake, but he did get sent off to his house and wasn't allowed to leave. So he changed fields, and he went back to mechanics. And then he thought again about this issue of buckling and the thickness of animals' legs. And basically what I can tell you is that the scale of the animal will tell you its mass, and what you're trying to do is to make sure that the diameter of this thing is of sufficient size so that the buckling force, which goes like 1 over the length squared, will not exceed a critical value. Here's another example that I love very much, which is, what sets the scale of how far migrating birds can fly without stopping? So where does this come from? So as Thomas mentioned, I've had the great privilege of leading 15 field trips around the world, Galapagos, New Zealand, Indonesia, Alaska. And the goal is to take students to see and appreciate especially island biogeography, because islands are weird from the standpoint of their flora and fauna. And so when we were in New Zealand, there was a particular naturalist, a lot of my skepticism. I don't know how many of you have been to ESPCI, but when you enter, on the left-hand side, you might have been there. I know Pierre has. I don't know, maybe one of you can say, there's a quote. It's very beautiful. It says, "True science teaches above all to doubt." Do you remember it? Do you, Pierre? Thank you. How do you say it in French? Forget it. Anyway, it's very, very cool. So one of my favorite games is to doubt the naturalists. Naturalists are always telling you stuff. And so one of the things the naturalists told us in New Zealand was, hey, there's this bird, the bar-tailed godwit. It migrates nonstop, Alaska to New Zealand. 10,000 kilometers, 10 days. Whoa. It loses a third, here's the part that the naturalist said. It loses a third of its body mass. I was just curious, did I buy that? Did that make sense? We'll just leave aside the question of navigation, by the way. How does a bird, I mean, you can work out, if you leave Alaska, calculate the angular tolerance of mistakes. It's nothing. Otherwise, you end up Antarctica. And they do not fly on a geodesic, interestingly. And they also do not fly in the south compass heading. It's pretty, you know, it's enough to make you really say, well, we don't understand very much. So, at any rate, the bottom line is that you can work out the power that it takes for them to fly. Again, I'm not going to go into the details, but you're welcome to look at the little vignette that I've said about it. The main point I want to make is you can work out a drag force. You can figure out, based on this fun thing, which is how much energy is stored in fat, you can work out the energy, and what you'll come to is, yep, they lose about a third of their mass. And it's amusing, too, because it's very much related to another calculation you can do, which is next time you fly across the ocean, just figure out how many tons of fuel did your plane take off with and how many did it land with. I was recently flying to Alaska, sitting next to a guy. I was reading a book. It was called Conversation. It was a philosophical interlude on conversation. And you know how it is, you're on a plane, there's a great cartoon. It's two people are sitting next to each other and they're each reading a book called Things You Will Never Understand. So this guy leaned over to me and he says, your book looks kind of interesting. You know, we hadn't talked for like 3 hours. He's like, I need to have conversation. I was like, whoa, what's this guy gonna say? Anyway, he's a FedEx pilot. Many of you may not know this, but Anchorage, Alaska is one of the main hubs for international air transport. You go there, there are tons of 747s, cargo planes. And so he's like, yeah, I spend 10 hours every day in a cockpit. And we got to have conversations. But here's the thing he told me that blew my mind. He said no matter what day they leave, they are so on top of weather and fuel consumption that they know to within 100 pounds how much fuel they're going to consume. In other words, they just plug in what their route is, and they know the day's winds and all that, and they, you don't like pounds, whatever. They know to within 50 kilograms how much fuel they're going to consume. Out of 60,000 tons, 60,000 pounds. So, you know, it's really, 60,000 pounds. Anyway, so the birds do indeed lose a third of their body mass. Okay, so my next question is, what sets the scale of the number of cows on planet Earth? So up on the top, let's look at the thing that says beef. Okay, I don't know if I'm smart enough to figure this out. I'm not. There we go, wow. So I want to look at beef. So the thought that I had was, let's say that half the humans on Earth eat about a kilogram of beef. You think that's too high? Okay, well that's fine.
By just a factor of two.
Fair enough. So this says few times 10 to the minus one, so that's like 300 grams per week. 52 works per year, and then you take the number of people that you think eat, I think it's half this, you'll get around 10 to the 11th kilograms per year. And then down here, you can estimate how many cows does that mean we need. So the mass per cow that's edible is a few hundred kilograms. Their lifespan is a few years. The population, this is using something I'm going to refer to in a sec, as Little's theorem, is around a billion beef cattle on the planet. And you know, here's the data. So this is the estimate I just told you. This is the total population. And this is dairy versus beef. We can do the same thing for chickens. You know, so just to put the numbers out in your mind, I mean, this is a homework for you. But we slaughter 80 billion chickens a year. 80 billion. We kill roughly 250 billion mussels, clams, and oysters. 250 billion per year. And the standing population of chickens is around 25 billion. So, you know, these are things that you can estimate. And, you know, here, this is the standing population by numbers. This is the standing population by biomass. So you can see cattle are really the thing. So each of us uses about 1,000, I would say each of us as Westerners uses about 2,000 square meters. So a fifth of the football field on Stade de France is your footprint for each of us. If you're somebody that eats a lot of beef, you need to put that up, add another at least factor of two. So 5,000 square meters for each of us per year for beef eaters. So if you want to pursue this a little bit, we created a database called the Human Impacts Database that imitates the BioNumbers database, where we try to put in a very curated fashion key numbers related to human impacts. Okay, next. What sets the link scale of gradients in cells and organisms? Why would I be interested in this? So maybe I can just fast forward for a second. Long ago, there was a speculation, let's say, by Louis Wolpert, that maybe, for example, the pattern of the French flag would emerge in an embryo as a result of the presence of what's called a morphogen gradient. And so there's a threshold, and if you're to the left of the threshold, you become red. If you're between two marks, you become white, and if you're to the right of the threshold, you become blue. And so he posited this, and what I will tell you is that one can estimate the length scale of that morphogen gradient as a competition between two different effects. One, the molecules are diffusing, and second, they are degraded over time. And out of that, a very simple estimate for the morphogen length scale emerges, but then a puzzle comes on its heels. And it's in a way a very trivial puzzle, and in another way it's a very super deep puzzle. And that is that if I have different species of flies, this theory in a way predicts they would all have the same length scale. But they don't. And it's a good thing, because if they did, they would be out of proportion. And so the question of how do you set up one of these gradients in a way that scales appropriately is actually a very interesting point. And again, what am I doing? I'm just trying to give you a little bit of tourism on this idea of what sets the scale of things. I'm not expecting you to leave this saying, oh yeah, I know how to calculate the length scale of a morphogen gradient, or I know how to do the number of cows eaten by humans or whatever. That's not the point. The point is a little bit of, oh yeah, you could actually by pure thought try to reason out these various scales. Here's a related one, and maybe I want to spend a few minutes on this because it's one of my favorite experiments ever. So there is a class of single-celled eukaryotes known as Chlamydomonas, and the way they get around is they swim. And they swim by doing breaststroke. They have two flagella, and they do this. That's what they do. And so a guy at Yale, Joel Rosenbaum, and then more recently Wallace Marshall, had the idea of cutting off one of these flagella and then looking at the dynamics of what happens post-cut. And this is what happens. So you cut this red one. It's now got this is length, and this is time. What happens is the blue one shrinks. The red one starts to grow again. When they hit the same length, then they grow to a new saturation length. Very, very beautiful, interesting, provocative experiment that demands an explanation. And it demands something more than words. Words will not cut it, at least for me. If somebody were to tell me a word story, I would say, go try again. You know, I want you to tell me what the slope is. I want you to tell me what the saturation value is. How do I tune this? And so on. So interestingly, what people like Wallace Marshall have figured out is that there's actually, inside of these flagella, there's microtubules, that's a kind of cytoskeleton, and there are motors that run along them and deliver molecules that cut off these green things. That leads to a gradient of these molecules, and that in turn leads to a length-dependent disassembly. And again, I'm just showing you this just as tourism, just to say that this little model that I just told you about can do a reasonable job, although there's some points that Wallace would disagree with, at describing the dynamics of both of the flagella after you do one of these cuts. Okay, my final big example is what sets the speed limit on cell division. So just to show you the movie again, I start out with a single cell that you see right here. It's red for reasons that are irrelevant. Okay, I could talk about that, but that's not the important point. What we're going to watch is a video of repeated cell divisions, and the question is, what sets that scale? We could ask the same thing about humans. Charles Darwin in On the Origin of Species asked it about elephants, interestingly. He wondered, why aren't there more elephants on the Earth? He literally asked that question. He said, what is it that determines? He knew what the generation time was. He knew over a certain number of generations how many elephants you would expect if they grew by exponential growth, and he knew that they didn't grow by exponential growth, and he was curious why. So watch. So they start to divide and divide and divide. And the question is, what sets the scale of that process? So I want to make sure that we don't take this for granted. So what is going on here? What's going on is you take 5 mLs, 5 cubic centimeters of water, you put a little sugar in it, you put a few salts in it, you put it in a machine that's like to boil it and make sure it's sterile, and then you put one cell in here, which is 1 picogram of mass. You put it in here, and then you shake it at 37 degrees for 24 hours, and then you will have 5 billion cells. So what happens is the cells have drawn out of the solution both the energy and the molecular contents to build new living matter. And so the question is, you know, what determines how fast they divide? So what's plotted here is the volume of the cells when they're born. This is their growth rate. So the faster they're growing, the farther to the right they are. And the question is, what's the speed limit? What is the fastest a cell could divide? So there's a number of hypotheses that we could come up with. For example, in order to grow, a cell needs a lot of carbon. It needs a bacterial cell needs on the order of 10 billion carbons. So if it needs 10 billion carbons and it has 1,000 seconds to divide, that means that it needs to take on board 10 million carbons every second. Where are those coming from? How does that work? They also have to synthesize proteins. They have to synthesize a few million proteins. They have to build a new cell wall and so on. So each of those might be rate limiting. So let me try to walk you through. This is a little overwhelming, but I just will try to give you a sense of it. So if I know that the cell takes a certain amount of time to divide, then you know I can ask, well, how long does it take to bring all the sugar in? How long does it take to bring the phosphate in? How long does it take to bring sulfate in and so on? How long does it take to make the energy currency of the cell? Given that I only have 5,000 seconds, how many of these various enzymes or transporters do I need? So let me just give you a sense of this. So as I mentioned at the beginning, we're kind of living in this era of big data where people, such as this really beautiful paper by Heinemann's group, well, what they do is they can go and ask the question. They can make a molecular census. It'd be like going to Paris and asking how many people are there of each age group? How many cab drivers are there? How many people are protesting on a given weekend? You know, like you could ask all sorts of questions like that. And that would be a census. And from it, we could learn about the nature of Paris. So you can ask a cell, how many transporters do you have? How many molecules that produce energy do you have? How many enzymes that work on given sugars do you have? And so on and so forth. So that's what this thing did, but they did it under 22 different growth conditions. And so I'm saying that we can actually, as I mentioned earlier, we can try to turn this into a story, into some sort of poetry. So let me give you an example of that. This, again, is a bit of a busy slide, but it has one simple message. The question is, how many transporters do I need in order to fulfill the needs of the cell for sugar? I know that a cell has a total mass of about 1 picogram. The dry mass is around 30% of that, and half of the dry mass is carbon. So that means there's 0.15 picograms of carbon in a given bacterium. I also know that one transporter can bring 200 sugars per second. And I need to bring on the order of 1 million sugars every second. So now what we're going to do is try and work out how many transporters are needed to do that. Well, if I know that there's roughly 100 sugars per second for each transporter, and I know I need to bring on about a million sugars every second, that means I need to have about 2,000 transporters, which is right down here. What's plotted here is number of transporters that were measured, that's here, as a function of the growth rate, using this mass spectrometry method. Over here, what I wanted to show you, again, this is maybe a little technical, but let me just try to say what the idea is. The idea is that cells, just like humans, have tastes, they have desires. If you were going to offer me foie gras or glazed donuts, I will always take glazed donuts, me. Maybe there are people here who would always take foie gras, I don't know, but I'm not one of them. So cells have preferences. They will always take glucose first. But if they run out of glucose and you offer them fructose or xylose, they will take it and use it, even though it's a lower quality source of carbon. And what's really interesting here is that this is growth rate, this is the number of copies of the transporter, and the way I want you to think of this is that they have a few transporters around just in case. Because if there is a shortage of glucose and there happens to be xylose, this thing will let in a little bit of xylose, and then there's feedback. And what the system says is, oh, now you're giving me xylose, I'm going to ramp up by a factor of 10 at least the number of xylose transporters or the number of fructose transporters and so on. Another one has to do with energy. So this is a very interesting graph. Let me try and explain what it says. So what Lynch and Marinov did is they said, well, let's look at how many molecules of ATP are needed for a cell as a function of how big the cell is. So here this is 1 micron cubed, this is 10 microns cubed, etc. This is where human cells are, somewhere around here. This is where a bacterial cell is. And what I want you to notice is this means that it takes around 10 to the 10th ATPs in order to fund the energetics of a cell, 10 to the 10th ATPs. So what I'm showing you over here is we can calculate how many of these ATP creating machines one needs, and it's around 3,000, and that's something that's borne out experimentally. But now I can ask a really interesting question, which is, the cell has a certain demand of energy. It has to have ATP in order to function. All of that ATP comes from the surface, in the sense that there are little machines that produce ATP at a rate of about 100 per second. And that ATP, which comes from the surface, has got to feed the whole cellular interior. But there's a problem, because as the cell gets bigger and bigger and bigger, you have to add more and more of these machines, these little factories, on the surface. And even when you get to the point where every bit of the real estate of the surface is filled up with these machines, they still are not producing ATP fast enough to feed the interior. And it's interesting, because that length scale is around 10 microns, which is sort of the scale at which eukaryotic cells start to exist. All right, so just to summarize what I've told you in this part of the talk was I just wanted to make the point that we could turn that spreadsheet into a story. We could try to understand all sorts of biological processes, energy, carbon transport, cell wall synthesis, production of more proteins, transcription, copying DNA. In each case, we can try to tell a story about how many of these objects we think we need to keep up with the demands of the cell, given their measured rates. All right, so I'm basically done. I hope maybe somebody will want to ask some questions. But what I'm going to try and say in the next couple of weeks is that that we're living in a really exciting moment. I would say that we're living in a moment in the study of the living which rivals the study of the heavens at the time of the invention of the telescope. When the telescope was invented, 1609, in 40 days, Galileo completely changed the face of science forever. Basically, you know, he proved, in a way, or refuted the geocentric picture of the solar system. And the thing I guess I wanted to say here was just to point out that biology is giving amazing gifts to the subject of physics. And what I mean by that is every time in the history of physics, when new phenomena have been attacked, first was mechanics, then came the subject of heat and temperature. It led people like Fourier to basically rewrite how we did science. Then electricity and magnetism came along. It required something more than we had in mechanics. Then right here in Paris, you know, the radioactivity was discovered, X-rays discovered in Germany by Becquerel, and that changed the things we had to think about and led to quantum mechanics. The study of the large-scale structure led to relativity. And one of the things that Schrödinger has to say is, why should the study of life be any different than all the other times in the history of physics? When we enlarge our view to include new phenomena, inevitably, we have to invent new concepts. Inevitably, we discover new principles. So I feel like biology is giving an amazing gift to physics, especially in the sense of making us come to terms with how to think about systems that are not in equilibrium. But similarly, physics is giving a lot of gifts to biology by letting us think about biological phenomena in different ways. So next week, what I will do is I'll talk about this idea of what I consider to be biology's greatest model, and we'll really focus on this notion of sameness. Today, the theme was above all having a sense of what sets the scale of X. But I really had four main things, I guess, I wanted to get across. First, a feeling for the organism. I wanted to first tell you about Barbara McClintock, the notion of being able to write the autobiography of every plant. And in a way, I'm inviting all of us, or at least inviting myself, with the idea of using mathematics to write the autobiography of biological phenomena. The next thing that I wanted to say, which I feel very strongly about, is that I feel that we're misguided in our love of facts. And Darwin himself said, all observation should be for or against some view to be of any service. He had been criticized for making hypotheses, as had Alfred Russel Wallace, criticized. And Darwin, in a letter, he said, according to these people, I should just go out into the world and collect rocks and report how smooth they are. You know, just stupid, sorry. But, you know, there's just way too much emphasis. We're in love with data as though that's all that there is. So this notion of concepts and intuition, I really want to push that, and I'm certainly going to push it again next week. And then, as I said, what sets the scale of X? I'm very excited about that as a window onto what it means to understand something. I gave you a number of examples, again, kind of in safari mode of like, we're out there, hey, look over there. How far can a bird fly without stopping? Or, you know, how many cows do we consume every year, or whatever choice you want to make. But my real case study that I did very superficially and probably badly was this idea of what sets the growth rate of bacteria. I want to also explain this. I'm guessing that many of you have heard of Cedric Villani, one of the most fascinating public speakers I know. You know, he's a mathematician and stuff, but I like his talks, both in French and in English. He's really a very interesting speaker. You know, kind of strange dude. Like, I don't know. I forgot how to say what he wears, but he was talking about knowledge. And he referred to us all as having a delocalized brain. And I love that image. So Thomas and I, we talk almost every day. I'll just make a joke. I always get my phone. I could do it right now in front of you. And I just say to Siri, I say, call Thomas Leckett, because that's what she thinks his name is. But then we talk. And I always think of our cerveau délocalisé somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. We have this brain that we share, that, you know, we know what each other are thinking about. And I love that notion. So, you know, in a way, the adventures in biology by the numbers are kind of a gift of the imagination, which we can all share in. And we can all agree. I mean, that's the beauty, in a way, of science, which is that I'll end with a story. We've just basically been doing recruiting to see who's going to come to Caltech for grad school. And we had an amazing young woman who was going to come in physics. And unfortunately, she decided not to go to Caltech. But I had a great time talking to her. And I asked her, how did she get into physics? And she said that she had a great high school teacher who told her, what we're going to do is we're going to figure out, by pure thought, when we roll a ball off of an inclined plane, where to put a bucket so that the ball will land in the bucket, just by doing a calculation. And here's what she said. She said, I did it, and it worked. And I just felt great. And I had that exact same kind of thing. It's like, it's amazing when we, different countries, different whatever, we can all say, yeah, I can call somebody and say, here's my notation, go away, you do a calculation, and we can actually agree. Pierre and I have done tons of calculations. We share a Dropbox folder, and we do things separately, and I'm not fast enough for him, but then we'll go to his board, and we'll end up getting the same answer. And that's just amazing. That's the power of science. I think it's really quite beautiful. So that's it. That's what I had for the day, and I'm happy to take questions if there's time.